University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum features Dr. Stanley Martin Hauerwas, Professor of Theological Ethics at the Divinity School at Duke University. His presentation is entitled, How to Live When Peace and Justice Do Not Embrace. Hauerwas is an ethicist whose primary concern is the basic methodological issues in theological ethics. In particular, he has stressed the importance of character and virtue for understanding the moral life. He has also developed the implications of narrative as a crucial concept for understanding Christian ethics. He has published on such issues as situation ethics, abortion, euthanasia, care of the retarded, and political theory. A graduate of Yale Divinity School and Yale University Graduate School, Hauerwas did his undergraduate work at Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas. He joined the faculty at Duke University in 1984 and has recently been appointed Director of Graduate Studies.
Thank you, Elaine. Well, Elaine's right. I don't remember her that well from Augustana. I'm in my 21st year of teaching, and boy, after you've been through that many faces, it's really hard to remember. It's terrible, and it's one of the terrible things of our lives that we don't stay stable enough today, that we don't have people with continuity in our lives that will give us a sense of who we are. Indeed, that's one of the things I'm going to talk about today, and in terms of how there's no way morally to survive the kind of society in which we live, and there's no solution. I don't offer you any solution. All I offer you is pathology. And therefore, it may sound a little odd. It was wonderful. Professor De La Garza took me to breakfast this morning at a lovely cafe right down from the school, and everyone knew one another. I don't know how odd you know if you know how that is in the kind of world in which we live today. And it has a definite political implications, unfortunately, not any that we can use for the power relationships in our society. So when I'm talking, you're going to say, one of the things you're going to keep saying, what is this guy's solution? And all he's telling me is church, and it doesn't sound like the church I go to. But I'm a theologian, and I speak normatively, and I hope you'll keep that in mind as I go forward. Now, many of us who were trained in the field of Christian ethics began our educations with the presumption that our primary task was to get the church, or at least Christians, involved in politics. We did so on the presumption that if you were interested in justice, then the way to justice is through the political. Christians may ultimately be about love, but justice, at least in this existence, is our game, we thought. This emphasis was often coupled with a critique of the churchiness of the church. People who think that the church is about spiritual matters, that is, about salvation of the individual, fail to appreciate the social character of salvation. Therefore, if you are a Christian, our task is to work for justice in the world. Thus, slogans such as, "The real business of the church is the world," or "The world sets the agenda for the church," or "Our task is to read the signs of the times and act accordingly." That oftentimes is still the presumption of many people around Nebraska, where Christianity still seems to be a viable religion, but has primarily to do with individual salvation, and therefore we're supposed to beat the hell out of you bunch of pietist individualists to say you really ought to be concerned with politics. Behind these slogans often lays a sociological presumption about the nature of the church in America. Namely, it is a sleeping giant, a great potential force for good in society if it can be awakened out of its lethargy. The American church is said by commentators like Martin Marty to consist of two types of churches, that is, the public churches and the private churches. So-called private churches are said to be those of conservative and evangelical bent who think that the saving of souls is the primary business of the church. We see those churches today primarily on TV. The public churches, those that generate people like me, who were called Christian ethicists, felt that Christians have an obligation to go public with their social agenda, working within the social structures of our society to make this a better country. Of course, the great apologist for this latter view was Reinhold Niebuhr. For it was Niebuhr who taught the public church that is the mainline churches, the Methodists, the Presbyterians, the United Church of Christ, how to understand the political process of democracy. As Niebuhr says, quote, "The democratic process is not so much a meeting of minds in which truth prevails, as it is a contest of interests dominated by the fortuitous circumstance, dominated by fortuitous circumstance and not by rational argument. Democracy must be regarded on the one hand as a system of government which men's rational and moral capacities make possible, and on the other hand as a system of checks and balances which the corruption by interest and passion make necessary. For these corruptions, as revealed in the campaign," and he's talking about the Eisenhower-Stevenson campaign, "for these corruptions, as revealed in the campaign, are precisely those that make life insufferable in a tyrannical regime and which are robbed of their virulence by the checks and balances of democracy. Thus, Niebuhr taught us the genius of democracy is to turn every issue of principle into an issue of interest." Of course, the current campaign between Bush and Dukakis is bland and boring, but that is the moral genius of our polity, namely to prevent those matters that people really care about from becoming before our politics, which might, as a matter of fact, therefore destroy us. Yet I want to challenge this view of church and politics. Of course, one of the ways it can be challenged is by noting the inadequacy of the distinction between the private and public church. Namely, the private church has now become the public church, at least if we believe Jerry Falwell. Namely, it's very interesting if you listen to the rhetoric of Jerry Falwell and see how it's structured. It's exactly the kinds of things that the Protestant social gospels were saying 100 years ago. We're just supposed to get out there and work for the moral renewal of our society because, as a matter of fact, democracies are inherently a good thing, and that the only thing that bothers the Protestant liberals. I mean, it's very interesting. As soon as Jerry Falwell starts talking about Protestant conservatives getting involved in politics, Protestant liberals then say, "Well, my God, you're not supposed to impose your religious beliefs on the political." I didn't hear them saying Martin Luther King that. I mean, the problem with Jerry Falwell is he just stands for political causes that they don't like. Only now he's trying to get Protestant evangelicals involved in the political process exactly on the same grounds that Reinhold Niebuhr told us we should be involved in it. Both, that is, the private and public churches, wrongly think that the American church's primary social task is to underwrite the moral presumptions of American democracy. On that, they agree. In doing so, moreover, they have and are unwittingly underwriting the moral and social presuppositions which destroy the ability of the church to be a social ethic in this society or any other. Aristotle argued that the primary purpose of the polis is the creation of people who are better than they would be without the aid of the polis, without the aid of the polis. Yet our society presupposes that the primary political entity is the individual, the omnipotent individual for whose society exists only to help foster ever more aggressive assertions of individuality. Society is formed for the supplying of our needs, no matter what the content of those needs are. Rather than helping us to judge our needs, to have the right needs which we exercise in right ways, our society becomes a vast supermarket of desire under the assumption that if we're free enough to assert ourselves and to choose whatever we want, we can defer eternally the question of what needs are worth having and on what basis right choices are made. What we call freedom becomes the tyranny, therefore, of our own desires. We are kept detached, strangers to one another, as we go about fulfilling our needs and asserting our rights. The individual is given a status which makes incomprehensible the Christian notion of salvation as a political, social phenomenon in the family of God. The church simply becomes one more consumer organization which exists to encourage individual fulfillment rather than a crucible to engender individual conversion into a body. Both so-called conservative and liberal theologies begin with the assumption that since we American Christians are fortunate enough to be born in a constitutional democracy, we Christians have no fundamental quarrel with the powers that be. Of course, we may not be particularly happy with the current national administrations or certain aspects of the legal process, but we believe that we have great power, unlike those who are not lucky enough to live in democracy, to change at will those administrations or legal relations at least every 4 years. And we modern people adore personal power because above almost anything else in our society, because we believe, in short, our society is built on the presumption that the good society is that in which each person gets to be their own tyrant. Of course, Bernard Shaw thought that that was exactly the right description of hell. Namely, hell is where you have to do what you want to do. In America, we call that freedom. Therefore, most contemporary Christians cannot say enough good about rights. They assume that the way to ensure the freedom of the individual, as well as creating a limited state, is to protect the rights of the individual. It's oftentimes said that America is a great pragmatic country which is not built upon theory. Of course, that's false. No country has ever been more theory-laden than America. Unfortunately, America has the disadvantage of being founded upon a philosophical mistake, namely the notion of inherent human rights. I do not believe in inherent human rights, because just for the same reason I don't believe in unicorns. I mean, they just don't exist. It has thus become our unquestionable assumption that every human person has the right to develop his or her own potential to the greatest possible extent, limited only by the parallel rights of others. However, Leslie Nubigen has pointed out in a wonderful little book called The Other Side of 1984, a wonderful book with a terrible title. He says, once the concept of human rights has established itself as an axiom, the question inevitably arises, how and by whom are these rights to be secured? With growing emphasis, post-Enlightenment societies have answered by the state. The nation-state replacing the old concepts of holy church and holy empire is the centerpiece of the political scene in post-Enlightenment Europe. After the trauma of religious wars of the 17th century, Europe settled down to the principle of religious coexistence, and the passions which had formerly been invested in rival interpretations of religion were more and more invested in the nation-state. Nationalism became the effective ideology of European peoples, always at times of crisis, proving stronger than any other ideology or religious force. If there is any entity to which the ultimate loyalty is due, it is the nation-state. In the 20th century, we have become accustomed to the fact that, in the name of our nation, Catholics will fight Catholics, Protestants will fight Protestants, and Marxists will fight Marxists. I oftentimes say that Roman Catholics, when you ask them about their social ethics, they often point to the social encyclical tradition beginning with Rerum Novarum, and therefore they fail to note the most extraordinary social achievement of Roman Catholics is how do you keep the Irish and the Italians in the same church? And they've done it. It is an extraordinary achievement. And supposedly, you cannot kill one another as Irish or Italian because you are Roman Catholics. You've got a hold against the nation state. But of course, they do that because Catholicism, of course, has a lot of trouble trying to see. I mean, I myself would like the imperialism of the papacy as opposed to the current nation state system. I take it that would be a great moral good for the Pope to say that Contras and Sandinistas in Nicaragua can't kill one another because they're Catholics. That'd be real interesting, wouldn't it? Nor can any Roman Catholic serve in the United States military as long as it's based upon a theory of deterrence that presupposes murder as a constant threat against another society. That'd be real interesting, because Catholics have just war views on these matters. The charge of blasphemy, Nubigen goes on to say, if it is made, is treated as a quaint anachronism. See, no one gives a damn if you really care about or say that you don't believe in God. But the charge of treason, of placing another loyalty above that to the nation state, is treated as an unforgivable crime in such societies. The nation state has taken the place of God. Responsibility for education, healing, and public welfare, which had formerly rested with the church, devolved more and more upon the nation state. In the present century, this movement has been vastly accelerated by the advent of the welfare state. National governments are widely assumed to be responsible for and capable of providing those things which former generations thought only God could provide, namely, that is, freedom from fear, hunger, disease, and want, in a word, happiness. Of course, what we fail to note is that the very state created to secure our rights is based upon the irresolvable dilemma because it has to present itself in two prima facie incompatible ways. Alasdair MacIntyre has characterized the dilemma in this way. The modern state is and has to be understood as an institutionalized set of devices whereby individuals may more or less effectively pursue their own goals. That is, it is essentially a means whose efficiency is to be evaluated by individuals in cost-benefit terms. That is, you are loyal to America because it's going to allow you to get ahead. Yet at the same time, it claims and cannot but claim the kind of allegiance claimed by those traditional political communities, the best type of Greek polis or the medieval commune, membership in which provided their citizens with a meaningful identity so that caring for the common good, even to the point of being willing to die for it, was no other than caring for what was good about oneself. The citizen of the modern state is thus invited to view the state intellectually in one way, that is, as a self-interested calculator, but imaginatively in quite another. The modern state presented only in the former light, that is, a self-interested calculator, could never inspire adequate devotion. Being asked to die for it would be like being asked to die for the telephone company. And yet, the modern state does need to ask its citizens to die for it, a need that requires it to find some quite other set of images for its self-preservation. Of course, that is why states, in particular states like the United States of America, are so dependent upon war as for our moral coherence. All societies may go to war, although we may not know what that means, since war is by no means a universal phenomenon. But war for us is special because it gives us a sense of worth necessary to sustain future wars. We are quite literally a people who morally live off our wars, as they give us the necessary image of sacrifice to compel what is otherwise a people taught to pursue their own interest to die for one another. You must remember, war is not based upon the presumption that it's all right to kill another human being. War is based upon the presumption that it is important for people to be able to make periodic sacrifices in the name of the societies that they think are well worth sacrificing for. That's the reason why people say stupid things. But people say, well, won't we do a lot better about peace when, as a matter of fact, we finally get women in high political office? Always have a two-word answer to that, Margaret Thatcher.
You've got to remember the women in the Trojan Wars that ran up and said, what of my son? And they said, they're dead, both of them. They said, wonderful. It'd been awful if they'd have come home alive. I wanted to make sacrifices for the good of society. As a result, we now fail to see as Christians in our urge to be political, you got to be politically involved, you got to be for Bush or Dukakis. We underwrite a politics based upon unbelief in the name of justice, but it is a justice that is indeed hollow. In her wonderful book, Women in War, Jean Beth Elstein quotes Randolph Bourne in 1918 to the fact, war, or at least modern war, waged by a democratic republic against a powerful enemy, seems to achieve for a nation almost all that the most inflamed political idealist could desire. Citizens are no longer indifferent to their government, but each cell of the body politic is brimming with life and activity. In a nation at war, every citizen identifies himself with the whole and feels immensely strengthened in that identification. In short, there's nothing wrong with America today that a good war won't cure. The problem is we just had a bad war. And it hurts our memory, and now we search deeply for a good war to be able to give us a sense of commonality. Moreover, it is against such a background that we must see the weakness of the liberal church's placid calls for peace with justice. For example, a few years ago, the National Council of Churches proclaimed one week in October, Peace with Justice Week. To help celebrate our one week for peace with justice, the council sent member congregations a Peace with Justice poster. The poster consisted of a globe, a world held aloft by a group of different colored hands. The Greeks had Atlas holding the world. The Arabs had a turtle. We more modern people have disposed of such inadequate mythology, showing clearly that we now have become Promethean. We have multicolored hands of the National Council of Churches to uphold the world with peace with justice. In the corner of the poster of the world upheld by the hands was a dove of peace, presumably. The dove was flying away from the world. This poster, I think, is an adequate depiction of our situation. It nicely embodies the assumption that the problem confronting us as Christians today is how to make the Christian faith credible to the modern world, not to challenge the modern world's unbelief. Yet I want to maintain that unbelief is exactly our most exacting political problem, not just intellectually, but socially and politically. Most of our social activism as Christians is formed on the presumption that God is superfluous to the formation of a world of peace and justice. Fortunately, we are a powerful people who, because we live in a democracy, we are free to use our power. It's all up to us. The moment that life is formed on the presumption that we are not participant in God's ongoing history of creation and redemption, participation which can only be understood and enacted in the church, we are acting on unbelief rather than faith. Got to be very clear about that. I don't particularly care about whether religious faith helps you have a meaningful existence or not. Only the bourgeois think that, just like they think that sex is always fulfilling. That sense of unbelief, that sense of belief just isn't very interesting. What faith means is to be engrafted into a body of people who claim that you are to live and act differently because you are not people that are determined by the powers of this existence. Your little individualistic concern about whether you believe or not simply isn't interesting from a Christian perspective. So when I talk about unbelief, I'm not talking about your subjectivistic concern about your whether you really believe in God or not. It's not interesting. Just not interesting. Does not the Bible teach us that war and injustice arise precisely at the moment we cease testifying as Christians that the world is in God's hands and therefore set out to take matters in our own hands? Why can't the National Council of Churches proclaim that to the world? The council cannot preach that on its posters because the council, like most American Christians, assume that the key to our political effectiveness lies in translating political assertions into terms which can be embraced by any thinking, sensitive, modern, though disbelieving average American. We want, therefore, peace with justice. And of course, what peace with justice usually means for conservatives is that we ought to always be ready to kill Russians because the only way to peace is through strength. And for liberals, it means that we ought to be ready to kill Contras in the name of liberation movements in Latin America. Both, what justice always is a code word that it's probably all right to kill someone in the name of a good cause. Christian politics has therefore come to mean for both conservative and liberal Christians, namely Christian social activism. Of course, conservative and liberal Christians may differ on the particulars of just what a truly Christian social agenda looks like, but we are one in our agreement that we should use our democratic power in a responsible way to make the world a better place in which to live. Jerry Falwell wants born-again people to be put in places of power. Prayers must be said in the public schools in order to counter secular humanism. United Methodists, on the other hand, urge the presidents to use military power in a restrained and humane manner. Such forms of thinking are forms of Constantinianism, which ironically continues to underwrite a culture of unbelief. American Christians, in the name of justice, try to create a society, therefore, in which faith in a living God is rendered irrelevant or private. For some, religion becomes a purely private matter of individual choice. Activist Christians who talk much about justice promote a notion of justice that envisions a society in which faith in God is rendered quite unnecessary since everybody already believes in peace and justice, even when everybody doesn't believe in God. Yet the political task of Christians is to be a church rather than to transform the world. One reason why it's not enough to say that our first task is to make the world better is that we Christians have no other means of accurately understanding the world unless, first of all, we are church rather than world. The first service that the church does for the world is help the world know that it is the world. Namely, it is all that which has taken God's patience and time to be willing to believe that it should determine the meaning of existence. And of course, church world runs through most of us. Because most of our lives, most of us aren't believers in any meaningful sense. Put differently, one of the most important, I'm a pacifist. That takes a lot of explaining, but I'm not going to explain it. I say it in public as often as I can because I'm obviously a violent person. I have no faith in myself to live up to those convictions at all. Therefore, I say it in public to try to create expectations in others that will keep me faithful to that commitment. But when you say that you're a pacifist, one of the first things that people do, I mean, people get very defensive and say, oh, you know, because most of us think, well, if someone broke into my home and was going to rape my wife, I'd kill them, you know, and that kind of, I mean, that's, so we're all filled with heroic virtue somehow. But then you translate that to, they say, what will we do when we're confronted by the Russians? Well, part of what is implicit in the way that I'm trying to suggest you think is for you to ask, who in the hell is the we? Who's the we? When did Christians start saying, we confronted with Russians? I mean, it's a little like, you know, the Lone Ranger in Toronto were surrounded by 20,000 Sioux up here in Nebraska. And the Lone Ranger turned to Tonto and said, boy, what are we going to do? And Tonto said, what do you mean we, white man? When did Christians start thinking that we were we's? That our interests are the same as the interests of the nation state? Individual rights don't keep the nation state limited. And people that know how to say no keep the nation state limited. Big words, therefore, in such contexts like peace and justice, slogans which the church adopts under the presumption that even if people don't know that Jesus Christ, what Jesus Christ as Lord means, they will know what peace and justice means, are words awaiting content. The church really doesn't know what these words mean apart from the life and death of Jesus of Nazareth. It is in Jesus' story that gives content to our faith and judges any institutional embodiment of either justice or peace. Therefore, the church is meant to give us the interpretive skills, that is, a truthful context whereby we first see the world for what it is. People often complain that the political agenda of conservative Christians looks suspiciously like the political agenda of conservative secularists, that is, the Republican Party on its knees. And it seems inconceivable that the Board of Global Ministries of the United Methodist Church should espouse some social position unlike that of most liberal or secular Democrats. The church is the boring exponent of secular political ideas with a vaguely religious tinting. Political theologies, whether the left or the right, therefore, want to maintain Christendom. The church is rendered a secondary status, therefore, to that project. Yet the very fact our world has learned it does not need religion may be the occasion that enables the Christian church in America to regain some of its lost theological integrity. Our continuing loss of Christendom gives us a joyous opportunity to reclaim the freedom to proclaim the gospel in a way which we cannot when the main social task of the church is to serve as one of the many helpful props for the state. I do not mean to argue that a purely sociological shift has led us or should lead us to modify our ecclesiology. The church has been all too willing to derive its theology from sociological assessments. Rather, my depiction of this sociological shift in the world of the American church arises out of theological commitments. The church does not exist to ask what needs doing to keep the world running smoothly and then to motivate Christian people to go do it. The church is not to be judged by how useful we are as a supportive institution and our clergy as members of the helping profession. The church has its own reason for being hid within its own mandate and not found in the world. We are not chartered by the emperor, even when that emperor is now clothed in the language of a state that promises freedom of the individual. H. Richard Niebuhr, in his classic book, Christ and Culture, offered a typology for conceptualizing our theological dilemma. Building on the work of Ernst Troeltsch, his categories of church sect, Niebuhr characterized ecclesial traditions as falling somewhere along a continuum of Christ above culture, and at the other end, Christ against culture. Despite the allegedly sociological nature of Niebuhr's book and its appearance as an objective description of the church and the world, it wasn't too difficult to discern which type of ecclesiology Niebuhr preferred, that is, the so-called Christ-transforming culture. Although Niebuhr put the liberals, that is, the social gospelers, in the Christ of culture camp, his own Christ-transforming culture was the church that liberal mainline American Protestantism wanted it to be. It neither capitulated to culture nor irresponsibly detached itself from that culture. The so-called transformist church busied itself with making America a better place in which to live, transforming society into something of which Jesus might approve. I think few books have been greater hindrance to an accurate assessment of our situation than Christ and Culture. I can't tell you how heretical that is. Many of you haven't read Christ and Culture, but Christ and Culture is the Bible for most of us that have grown up in mainline Christianity. And I'm telling you, it is a destructive book. While Niebuhr rightly saw that our politics determines our theology, he was right that Christians cannot reject something called culture, but his call for Christians to accept something called culture, where this is monolithically understood as deriving from God's creative will, and also an equally monolithic politics in the name of the unity of God's creating and redeeming activity, has had the effect of endorsing a Constantinian social strategy. Culture became a blanket term to underwrite Christian involvement with the world without providing any discriminating modes for discerning how Christians should see the good or the bad in culture. If you want to understand that, I mean, what are colleges like Nebraska Wesleyan built upon? Colleges like Nebraska Wesleyan are built upon the presumption that Christians need to build colleges through which you get humanistic education that will allow you to be effective power actors within the high culture of advanced capitalist societies. If, as a matter of fact, your parents thought by coming here you might be formed by Christian convictions in a way that you might seriously never consider serving in the United States military or becoming a board member for IBM, do you think they would send you here? No way. Nebraska Wesleyan is the way that Christians continue to acculturate our children into high capitalist cultures in a way that, as a matter of fact, you do not feel any tension between what it means to be a Christian and what it means to be a political actor. That's what Christ-transforming culture resulted in. Namely, we're going to culture you. We just make you more refined consumers. You know you shouldn't buy tigers on black velvet. Niebuhr set up the argument in such a way as to assure that the transformist approach would be viewed as the most worthy. A democracy like ours must believe that it's making progress, that the people are, through their own power and choice, transforming the world into something better than it would have been without their power or choice. Thus, Niebuhr set up the argument as if some world-affirming church or some world-denying sect were our only options, as if those categories were a faithful depiction of some historical sociological reality in the first place. In good liberal fashion, Niebuhr assured that the ecclesiology, which was the most inclusive, would be viewed as the most truthful, that any church that became too concerned about its own identity and formation of its young would be rejected by American culture as incipiently sectarian, as irresponsible in a state which had given us the political tools to transform the world. Of course, there's a subtle repressiveness behind this seemingly innocuous pluralism. Niebuhr failed to describe the various historical or contemporary options for the church. He merely justified what was already there, a church which had ceased to ask the right questions as it went about congratulating itself for transforming the world while the world had fatally co-opted the church. It was Niebuhr who taught us to be suspicious, therefore, of anyone that appeared sectarian. That's what people call me. I'm a fideistic, tribalistic sectarian. That's what I'm called. The church should be willing to suppress its particularities in order to participate responsibly in culture. Once again, this is the same culture which gave us the wonderful examples of Hiroshima and Dachau. That sounds like an unduly harsh judgment on the thought of a great Christian like Niebuhr, a man who would abhorred the violence of Hiroshima, a man who tried to find in his theology a place to affirm the unique witness of the church. If the problem remains within the structure of the categories of Christ and culture, lies the temptation to believe that Christians are in an all-or-nothing relationship to our culture. We must responsibly choose to be all or irresponsibly choose to be a sectarian nothing. When the church confronts the world with a political alternative which the world would not otherwise know, is it being sectarian? The early Anabaptists, that is the left wing of the Reformation, who I say that the only thing that Catholics and mainstream Protestants could agree upon in the 16th and 17th century was probably a good idea to kill the Anabaptist. The early Anabaptists had no desire to withdraw from the world, and neither should we. They were murdered by Calvinist, Lutheran, and Roman Catholic societies because they attempted to be the church. Their withdrawal came in an attempt to keep people, most of whom called themselves Christians, from killing their children. They didn't withdraw, they were driven out. The worst that the Constantinian Church can say in its last gasp for life in a post-Constantinian situation as that this account of the church sounds suspiciously tribal. It's very interesting how that word tribal is taken on a very negative form. People think, oh, it's terrible to be part of a tribe. You got to be an individual. You got to be able to choose your identity freely. That's the reason why even in America, Catholic, Irish, and Italian people learn to say that, well, I really like a lot of my ethnic heritage. Like ethnic heritage? I mean, that's like a Greek Orthodox saying, I'm just a tradition. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. I mean, I want to be essentially Italian. I don't want to be an Italian thing, you know, somehow or the other. The notion of tribe is very interesting. What we've done to that, people forget that Western imperialism, for example, has won in Africa. How did we win in Africa? Because we convinced Africans, in order to be actors on the world scene, they can no longer be tribes. So nation states now are able to draw boundaries between tribes and therefore separate tribal people on grounds of arbitrary boundaries that create nation states. That is, states that have all the presumptions of modernity that says, first of all, you are to be individually related to the state rather than to your tribe. Of course, that's exactly the basis which up in this area and through the upper and through the southeast that Americans killed the American Indians in a genocidal war. It was perfectly all right to do away with the American Indian because, after all, they were tribes. We were just trying to make them part of the mainstream. They didn't understand. If we're going to live in a world of the bomb, we Christians must be willing, it is said, to suppress our particularities, join hands with whomever will join hands with us, and work for peace and justice. Therefore, most ecclesial statements today, when they make statements about nuclear weapons, say, Jesus, God, we're going to kill everything. That's bad. We ought to stop from doing that because we want to live. Well, that's not the basis for the Christian protestation against nuclear weapons. Christian protestation against nuclear weapons is they threaten murder. No ethic is worthy that would not require your life this instant. The moral life isn't built upon survival. It's built on what you think is worth dying. When the church only underwrites the bourgeois assumption that survival is good in and of itself, then, as a matter of fact, we underwrite the culture of unbelief. But we call it justice. Under this argument, to the extent that Christians or Jews or Muslims refuse to take the modern nation state more seriously than the particularity as Christians, they are accused of being tribal, hindrances to the creation of a new world order based upon national cooperation. Constantinianism has always demanded one unified state religion in order to keep the empire together. Today, the new universal religion, which demands subservience, is not really Marxism or capitalism, but the entity which both those ideologies serve, namely the omnipotent state. To be charged with tribalism, particularly from those whose theologies serve to enhance the most nefarious brand of tribalism of all, that is, the omnipotent state, is surely odd. The church is the one political entity in our culture which is global, transnational, and transcultural. Tribalism is not the church which is determined to serve God rather than Caesar. Tribalism is the United States of America which sets up artificial boundaries which defends them with murderous intensity. And the tribalism of nations occur most viciously in the absence of a church which is able to say and to show in its life together that God, not nations, rule the world. Therefore, in saying that the church doesn't have a social strategy, the church, when it's faithful, is a social strategy, I'm attempting to indicate an alternative way of looking at the political and social significance of the church. The church need not feel caught between false Niebuhrian dilemmas of whether or not to be in or out of the world, politically responsible or introspectively irresponsible. The church isn't out of the world. There's no place for the church to be than in the world. In the 60s, it became fashionable to speak of the need for the church to be in the world, serving the world. Yet being in the world, serving the world, has never been a great problem for the church. Alas, our greatest tragedies occur in part because the church was all too willing to serve the world. The church need not worry about whether or not to be in the world. The church's only concern should be how to be in the world and in what form and for what purpose. Nazi Germany is a devastating test case for the church. The capitulation of the church before Nazism, the theological incapacity of the church to see things clearly and to call them by their proper names, sends a chill down the spine of today's church. Yet there were some who, though they did not always know what was to be done, at least had retained the vision to say what was true. That was what we call the confessing church. Was this church being liberal or conservative, sectarian or tribal when it said no to Hitler? And if you think you'd say no to Hitler, you're wrong. Hitler was the most democratically elected political ruler our century has seen. It was done with the free consent of German, Catholic, and Lutheran people. In 1934, when Karl Barth wrote the Barmian Declaration, I mean, if you say, well, if I'd have been there, I mean, I always feel like that when I was, if we think of ourselves like Nazi Germany, the way my cousin Billy Dick, only in Texas would you have a name like Billy Dick. My cousin, when he was 6 years old, was in Sunday school, and he was listening, and the first time the story of the crucifixion came across to him, and he was listening to it, and he suddenly stood up. I come from a family of bricklayers, so we learned to talk differently. And Billy Dick stood up and said to the Sunday school teacher, well, if Gene Autry had been there, the dirty SOBs wouldn't have done it. And that's exactly what we think. If we'd have been in Nazi Germany, they wouldn't have done it. We'd have stood tall. Mm-mm. We'd have fought loyally in Hitler's armies, just like the Lutherans and Catholics did on the basis of Romans 13. That's who we'd have been. But there were voices that stood against it. In 1934, Karl Barth wrote the Barmian Declaration, which says, Jesus Christ, as he is attested for us in Holy Scripture, is the one word of God which we have to hear and which we have to trust and obey in life and in death. We reject the false doctrine as though the church could and would have to acknowledge as a source of its proclamation, apart and besides this one word of God, still other events and powers, figures and truth as God's revelation. Note the exclusive, not the inclusive nature of this declaration, its determination not first to do the right but to hear the right, again to assert the rather imperialistic claim of the lordship of Christ. The Barmian Declaration stands in marked contrast to a church willing to adjust its claims to those of Caesar in service to the world. I think what I've tried to say can be nicely summed up by a conversation a friend of mine had recently at Duke University. It's Will Willimon, who has got the ambiguous title of being minister to the university. Right after the United States bombed military and civilian targets in Libya, Will came across a debate concerning the morality of that act, a couple of kids on campus. And there were some that thought it was a wonderful thing to do, and others thought it was an immoral act. At one point in the argument, one of the students turned to Will and said, well, what do you think? Since he's the minister of the university, he's supposed to have the moral answers for these matters. He said that as a Christian, he could never support bombing, particularly bombing of civilians, as an ethical act. One of the conversants responded, well, that's just what we expected you to say. That's typical of you Christians, always on high moral ground, aren't you? You get so upset when a terrorist guns down a little girl in an airport, but when President Reagan tries to get these things right, you get indignant when a few Libyans get hurt. The respondents' presumptions were there were only two political options: either conservative support of the administration or liberal condemnation of the administration followed by efforts to let the UN handle it. Will said, you know, you have a point. What would be a Christian response to this? Then he said, a Christian response might be that tomorrow morning the United Methodist Church announces that it's sending 1,000 Christians to live in Libya. We have discovered that it's fertile land for the gospel. We know how to send missionaries. Here, at least, is a traditional Christian response. You can't do that, one of the students said. Why, he asked. You tell me why. The student said, because it's illegal to travel to Libya. President Reagan will not give you a visa to go there. Will said, no, that's not right. I'll admit that we can't go to Libya, but not because of President Reagan. We can't go there because we no longer have a church which produces people that can do anything that bold. But we once did, and that's the sadness of why it is we live at a time that peace and justice can't embrace, because we don't have a church that knows how to say no. Thank you very much.
Today on University Forum, we have heard Dr. Stanley Martin Haurwitz, professor of theological ethics at the Divinity School at Duke University. He spoke on how to live when peace and justice do not embrace. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts college located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 students are enrolled in more than 40 major programs.